Okay, so. So, where is my window? There's my window. Okay, so last time we went through how Rust works. We had to go over general syntax to have it make sense what was happening with respect to the rules for ownership, which were the really interesting parts for us. So Rust declared these variables where it put the type after the variable. It had the option for inferring the type. So if you like did let name equals 32, it would figure out that name was a type of integer. We could, you know, declare references using the ampersand, and a reference would be kind of like a pointer in as far as Rust is concerned. It's not so much like C++, where references sort of automatically to reference. So we'd create them using this sort of address of operator and to reference them using this star operator. We also saw that Rust had this policy that it distinguished between values which were mutable and constant, and it defaulted to constant values, which turned out to be kind of useful for reasoning about things like dangling pointers, because a big concern is if a pointer we have is going to be reassigned to something. So Rust wants to make that more explicit. So you mark variables that are mutable as mutable explicitly. When you have a reference that goes to a mutable type, you mark it as mutable explicitly. This was different than having a type that here that was a mutable reference to something. It's different than having a, so I should say Z, Y. So this first example is a reference we can make refer to something else, point to something else. And the second example is a reference which we can use to change the thing it refers to. And we saw also the syntax for declaring functions. Now, given that Rust has these references, it added these rules that the compiler enforces that ensure that we don't have the problem of dangling pointers. And this means that we're going to have to add restrictions to how references and passing objects around work. And we saw that sort of the basic idea that the rules Rust enforces were built around was this idea of ownership. And this is actually sort of a very old and common concept if you're teaching people how do you write like C++ code that doesn't have problems. The issue is that in C++, well, the compiler's not really going to help you out very much with making sure that you're actually obeying that rule. And the simplest version of this rule is that everything has one owner, and only the owner can access the object, and we can move the object to a new owner. So if you follow this rule, well, you're not going to have dangling pointers because there's only one pointer to the thing. And, well, that's not actually very useful. So we went to kind of have a more flexible version of that. And one more flexible version that Rust supports, and that's sort of the big complicated thing it does with references, is that it allows this borrowing, that you can temporarily move the reference to some other owner and have it move back. And the sort of classic example we saw of this is passing something to a function for it to use. And when the function's done, it guarantees that it's not storing a reference to that. So sort of the innovation here is that, you know, sort of the function type, you know, tells us, you know, if the function is borrowing the object versus whether it's, you know, taking it, you know, permanently. Now, that's actually different, and the compiler enforces that and makes sure you don't accidentally write a function that looks like it's just borrowing the objects that's actually going to use it long term. And there's a third way that Rust gives a little more flexibility is that because it's tracking whether things can be modified, we can also say that an object can be borrowed multiple times if we're only reading it, because, you know, we can have multiple readers. We don't have to worry about use after free as long as we're assured that, you know, we're not going to have any confusion about when the object is going to be deallocated. But if we have someone writing it, well, in other places reading it, we might be worried about, like, pointers changing as that's happening and getting confused as a result of that. Like if we think of a vector, you know, so not writable. So the example is, like, let's say we have a vector, you know, if the size of the internal array changes, we might need to do some extra work to make sure we know that that's okay. We won't be using the old array. So if all people are only reading, that's not going to be a concern. Okay. And after talking about the rules that Rust enforces, we realized that, well, you know, these rules don't handle all scenarios. And, you know, if we just enforce these rules, we'd kind of had the same problem that made it so people weren't using languages like Java or Python for the kind of code that, say, C or C++ was targeting, which is that when you went to do something, quote unquote, fancy, like, there wasn't a convenient way to do it. So Rust has these sort of convenient escape hatches. And the idea is that you can write types, and we saw actually some examples of this in our original example code of, like, vec was one of these. And the implementing code for this would be explicitly marked unsafe. And the idea is that if you're trying to figure out, is this code secure or not, you can look at that unsafe code very carefully and know that you can kind of just look at that alone and not need to worry about, like, looking at the whole program. And maybe we could use things like static analysis techniques to, like, somehow prove in some sense that code is, you know, correct, at least in the sense of, like, avoiding use after free problems. And we saw that this could be used to implement other rules, so we saw the example of reference counting. And we also briefly went into another issue that comes up when we're talking about sort of enforcing this memory safety property. The big issue we had there was with concurrency, that one of the big reasons people are, you know, trying to use C and C++ is writing things like operating systems where often we're trying to, like, get the best performance and use multiple cores and multiple threads. And there are problems with just taking code that's designed to use one thread and using multiple threads, in particular where we can have a memory safety issue. And we saw one example of this with this reference counting idea. So the reference counting rule is we tracked how many pointers there were to something, and when that number went to zero, we freed it. If it didn't go to zero, we didn't. But we saw that if we weren't careful, we could have that number become wrong because of using multiple cores. And we could say, well, when you're implementing your code that uses this escape hatch to do reference counting, it has to handle multiple threads, but that wouldn't obey our zero overhead idea. So Rust's solution is that you have separate types for when you're dealing with multiple threads versus not, and there's a way to mark types you're creating, like the, say, RC type for reference counting, as thread safe or not thread safe, as something you can use in a multi-core scenario or not. So before I move on today, questions about these things we covered last time? So I know I just feel like I rushed through a lot of stuff. Okay, then a logistics note. So I was thinking of having an assignment on Rust for next week's assignment, and I put together basically all of an assignment, and I came to the conclusion that rather than the idea for the assignment was, here's a C++ program with a use after free bug, let's re-implement it in Rust, and, like, have you fill in the blank rest of the implementation. And I came to the conclusion that I have this skeleton code, and I think a lot of you would come up with a solution where you just wouldn't use anything like references to handle the tricky part, rather than unlike the original C++ code. And it feels like awkward to enforce that, so I think I'm just going to drop this assignment, and we'll have the next assignment be sort of our final assignment. My plan for that is to, which I will talk more about next week, is to have part of it be basically a final quiz, and part of it be a a challenge assignment where we're going to have a bunch of programs that are sort of like our use after free and overflow assignment, where kind of the goal is to make the program output a particular thing. So a bunch of those that cover all the sort of exploits we went over in the semester, including some we might not have had assignments on, like format string exploits. And the way I did it last time I taught this course is I gave out 7 of those programs, and you could do any 5 for full credit. So questions about those logistics? So a question is, there a written final on top of that? So if I do a final quiz, probably the way it would work is I give you at least a 24-hour time window, and it would, the questions would be kind of similar to quiz questions, but maybe there would be some like short answer that are manually graded, because we'll spend time doing actual manual grading. Does that answer that question? Okay. Other questions? As I said, I'll finalize details about this after I talk to my TAs on Monday. Okay. So last time when we finished up, we mentioned, okay, Rust had this idea that for RC, there's going to be 2 implementations, and basically one of these are going to be marked as okay to use with multiple threads, using these 2 traits Rust have, and one isn't. And Rust will enforce this by having the threading functions will say, no, you can't do that if you try to pass this RC type into another thread. So, and threads, if you haven't taken a course that uses threads like COA 2 or OS, are sort of the abstraction we typically use for running code on 2 cores at once and sharing memory. And handling this case is actually very important, because concurrency is a big cause of use after free bugs. So, for example, there is a paper in the USENIX Advanced Technical Conference that try to do some static analysis to find concurrency bugs. And these are the things that just happen by accident a lot of the time. And they found some in Linux drivers. And you know, these just are things that are easy to look miss. And here the problem was that they were doing things where they did this locking, where the idea is that the code in here can't execute at the same time as the code in here. So these are, so this is mutex. Execute at the same time. And they thought, okay, well, that's going to keep us from doing dangerous things. But they just apparently just misplaced these mutexes, because they were actually freeing something while it might be used. And that wasn't ensured with these mutexes. So they made a mistake here. And this is a use after free bug that is really tricky to find. You know, so we talked about like static analysis techniques for finding it. The reason why this is a recent research paper is that, well, you know, we talked about having too many paths with code where we didn't have to worry about multiple cores. With multiple cores, this problem gets way worse. And it's hard for machines to find, and also hard for humans to find these bugs. And when they do, these can be something in something like an OS that you could make a reliable exploit by, you know, running programs that try to make these functions run a lot, so eventually this scenario happens. And the question is, the problem here is that the free isn't in the mutex. So that is basically the main issue with this problem, is that, yes, this free is not properly put inside this mutex lock. So we're not ensuring that this free doesn't happen while this code here runs. So we mentioned for Rust this reference counting policy. Rust provides a few other policies that are really common. And I think these are enough to like handle pretty most code. But like reference counting, most of these policies have a bit of overhead. So, for example, Rust provides something it calls a ref cell, which implements the single owner policy, but the check is at runtime, where the idea is, you know, we can't assume we know whether or not we're borrowing consistently. So rather than having the compiler figure out, oh, this function's using this object while we're calling that, it'll say, oh, you started using it because you made a call to the get method at this point and didn't make a call to the put back method, basically. There's also this type called weak, which is used with reference counting. So an issue with reference counting, and something that's subtle about it, is you might say, okay, this RC class is ensuring that we don't have memory errors, but it doesn't actually. So if you think of having an object A that has a pointer to, say, a B object, maybe a concrete example of this might be like a, say, a student and a class object. Like our student might have a pointer to a class object, and our class might have a pointer to the student object. If we think of how this works with reference counting, and we have like some pointer to a student and a pointer to a class from elsewhere. So you think of how this works with reference counting, we have two references here and also two references here. And let's say that we stop using this class and stop using the student. Well, then this two will go down to one, because that reference will go away, and this two will go down to one. So we'll have one reference to each of these, and these A and B here will never be freed. So reference counting doesn't actually prevent you from leaking memory. In fact, that's, you know, erroneous code with reference counting can leak memory. And you might say, wait a moment, I thought Rust was supposed to prevent memory errors. Well, it's supposed to prevent the memory errors that are really bad. So it doesn't prevent you from leaking memory. So this weak type is meant to kind of mitigate that, where we can have some object which is a reference but doesn't contribute to the count. So the idea with this is that we have this weak pointer, so the count would be, so A and B could be pointing to each other with these weak pointers, and the count would be just one in both cases, and the count would go down to zero. So let's say, for example, that our pointer to the class here, this was a weak pointer. So in that case, so I'll start the scenario at the beginning. We have A points to B, but this is our weak pointer here, B, and we have a pointer to B. And B points to A. And let's say we get rid of our pointer to A. And, well, we'll do the other order. So we get rid of our pointer to B. Okay. So in that case, B's count will go from 1 to 0. Because the count before here, before we get rid of the pointer, is 1. This is, we have 1, and this one does not contribute to count. So we'd have a reference count of 1. So when we got rid of that reference, the count would go to 0. And then you might say, well, this is a dangling pointer now, right? We have a pointer to B, which, because the count went to 0, we got rid of, goes now. So the extra work at runtime that this weak type will do is that it will detect if the count equals 0, and rather than letting you have giving you a pointer to uninitialized memory, it will always trigger an error. So that's what I mean by detecting at runtime if the count was 0. So we'll let the object B go away, but we'll detect if somehow we end up using the pointer from A here. Rust also has some types to deal with multi-threading. So if you're familiar with mutex locks, Rust has a mutex that appears as one of these sort of pointer types, where when you borrow the object from the mutex, that locks the mutex and unlocks it. So if you're familiar with mutexes, this is kind of an, I would say, elegant interface to a mutex. So questions? questions about these other ideas for sort of other policies that we can implement in the same kind of way where, you know, we're writing some unsafe code. Yeah. That implements a checkable safe policy. So the question is, why is this mutex different from C? So if you're familiar with mutexes that we sort of, for example, learned in operating systems, this is the same underlying idea that we have something that you can only use from one thread at a time. But rather than have the interface be that you call lock and unlock, yet the interface is you call get object and to borrow it, and you call and you return the object to put it back. But it's the same underlying thing that we're accessing. Okay. And the hope that sort of Rust has here is that, you know, most of the time we can use the lifetime idea that's all in the compiler and there's no overhead. And the other policies, you know, they're not no overhead. So they're not like the sort of most naturally equivalent C++ code maybe. But, you know, hopefully we can implement a policy that's safe and good enough for all our tasks. Now, so we went through this idea that Rust is doing all this work to prevent use after free bugs. And this idea that we can modify our language to prevent us from writing unsafe code, or at least prevent us from writing unsafe code unless we're doing something that, if we're reading the code, is obviously exceptional. So in Rust, obviously exceptional because we'll see the word unsafe because we're saying, hey, don't enforce this ownership thing anymore. You know, maybe there's other policies we can try to enforce. And a bunch of these are things that people have tried in various ways. So, for example, I'll give some concrete examples of this first one in a second. So one thing we saw with taint tracking is that, you know, we had this idea that we could enforce at runtime or by doing some static analysis, we could check, oh, does sensitive data like a, you know, input end up in the SQL query. And we could imagine enforcing this in the same kind of way where the compiler does it, where, you know, rather than just being something we detect sort of on the side, that like the sensitive data has a different type and it's an error in the compiler to assign it to something that's not supposed to take sensitive data. So you could imagine making a programming language enforce this, you know, a convention that you separate your sensitive and non-sensitive data rather than just tracking it like we saw with taint tracking. You could imagine enforcing that code has bounded runtime, for example, by making your language not allow you to use constructs that could potentially be an infinite loop. This would be a less powerful language, but for some tasks, that might be what you want. You know, if you're really concerned about, let's make sure, you know, this program doesn't run forever. And one thing that's been an actual concern and sort of an example of recent research in this area is that often we've been concerned about the runtime of code depending on secret data. So especially in cryptography, a big way people writing cryptographic code have gotten into trouble is by having their code take different amounts of time depending on what the secret key is. And if you do this, well, if someone measures the amount of time you take, they can figure out part of your secret key and often all of your secret key with a little bit of work. And you might say, well, how would this happen? So probably the classic case is that we can use to illustrate this problem would be with RSA. So if I believe you've covered RSA briefly in Intro to Cybersecurity, or some other course, hopefully. So an RSA, sort of the fundamental mathematical operation we're doing is this I should say, this message to a D. So this message to a secret exponent mod N. And this is supposed to be secret. It's really bad if this would be revealed. And the most common way, but a natural way to implement this, and what people often had naively tried, is that if D here is 10110, you know, if we write D out in binary, then let's say it's this, then we can say that this is going to be equal to, so if this is our 1's place, our 2's place, our 4's place, this is equal to m to the 2 times m to the 4 times 16, m to the 16, and so on. So we can do this exponentiation by using our power laws and getting these, and multiplying together these different powers of 2 exponents. So in this case, I did 2 because the 2's place is set, and the 4's place is set, and the 16's place is set. So that's what I chose to multiply, and not the ones where the place wasn't set. And that will compute this exponent mod n. So questions about this process? So if this is how we implement exponentiation, so one example of how we would leak information here is that how many multiply operations we perform is going to depend on how many ones are set in this secret value. So if you do implement this in this naive way, an adversary can time your code to figure out how many ones there are, and that turns out to give a lot of information about what the secret is, and often can, make it much faster to use other methods to, fill in the blanks and compute the secret. Especially if there's other information leaks in addition to this. And similar issues all come up with cache performance. So if you are using a processor with a data cache, and let's say your encryption algorithm does something like table key byte key of 3, for example, then how much time this takes will depend on whether this part of the table has been accessed recently if we're using caching. So these sorts of issues are really problematic when implementing cryptographic algorithms, because often they, basically defeat the purpose. So to avoid that, there's been a bunch of kind of recent work. So this is at the Programming Language Design and Implementation Conference and the Principles of Object-Oriented of, I actually don't remember what the, something, Principles of Programming Languages, I believe, is PAPL. These are two of the most important programming language conferences where people have implemented these sort of custom languages, which are, extensions of languages for writing cryptographic code, which doesn't have this problem. And basically what they did in these approaches, which, as I said, they're recent research, so there's not consensus that these are the best approaches. They said, okay, we're going to have a separate type for secret data. So there's going to be a secret keyword, and some think values are secret, some aren't. And the compiler is not going to allow you to do things that would be variable time. So for example, using a secret value, that type, as an array index is going to say, sorry, you can't index arrays with secret values. It's not allowed. And it's not allowed because it's variable time. And other operations that are variable time also won't be allowed, So you won't be able to do integer division. That turns out not to be constant time. You won't be able to do a comparison on a secret value. That's not going to be allowed because that's not going to be constant time. Or if it is allowed, that's either not going to be allowed, so not allowed, or it's compiled in a very special way. And I think they've done both. So the question is, what does secret value refer to? So in these approaches, the idea is that you mark, as the programmer, what values coming into your code are secret. So if we're talking about the cryptographic examples, this would be like your secret key. And this programming language would enforce that you don't do anything that would reveal part of your secret key based on the input. And question, would we mark user input this way? And that probably depends on the context, but probably you would mark inputs that are supposed to be kept secret. So for example, if we're encrypting something, the input to the encryption, you probably also mark as secret, yes. Other questions? Okay. So that includes my foray into just telling you that there's this universe of ideas for, you know, using these programming language ideas to help us write secure code. So questions about that before I move on to my next topic, which is going to be about sandboxing, which is going to try to deal with security programs in kind of at a different level, where we're not going to secure the program directly, we're going to make security problems less bad. Okay. So there's a principle that maybe was covered in a prior course called least privilege, that, you know, we typically want to run programs that are allowed to do as little as possible, that we want to set up our system so we don't allow programs to do things that, you know, aren't really necessary. And say, okay, well, let's think of whether this is happening. And if we look at a typical desktop, this is a disaster. So pretty much every program on my desktop that I run can make connections to anywhere. So I'm running a text editor, it can open up a network connection. It's allowed to do that. Can make a connection everywhere. It can read all my files, even ones I'm not editing right now. It can delete all my files. It can record all my keystrokes while it's running and do anything with them, even if I don't have the program focused. So in this sense, programs have the ability to do lots of things that they really aren't supposed to be able to do. And we'd really like to get to a world where, you know, if a typical program was malicious, that we wouldn't have to worry about this, that it wouldn't be the case that I'm running a malicious program, the result is everything is host. You know, because most of the programs I run, you know, shouldn't be able to do this, shouldn't have to access these things all the time. Now, so as an example, let's think about sort of what should programs be able to do. So here I have a list of tasks. What are things that I have two example programs that maybe, you know, shouldn't be able to do everything. So let's think about browsers and word processors. What things should they be allowed to do? So let's think about limiting it because, well, you know, it shouldn't be the case that all my programs should be able to access everything. Let's see if we have consensus here, because and there's a comment here that some of these things feel like things that we want to allow sometimes, that we want to allow if the user approves. And that's a nice idea. And a good question is, how can we implement that sort of, you know, limitation? How could we make it possible to do these things, but not make it so the program can just do it whenever it wants? That's a tricky question. So let's see. So on things browsers should be able to do, we have consensus on displaying things on the screen. And we have reasonable consensus on resizing windows. And we have this idea that, well, probably they need to record audio and video because we use web applications that do that. And also, most people say network connections everywhere, but not everyone. So I guess an observation you might have about that is maybe they shouldn't be able to do that. And we have less consensus on saving files. So writing files, write files, read files. I'm surprised by the split and replace files. So I would assert that most of your browsers commonly use the functionality of writing and replacing and reading files. And why do they do that? Well, here we go. There's a Save Link As button that you may use occasionally. Download files. And also you can upload files in browsers, like you've probably done to submit them for this class. And when we get to that, it seems like browsers need to do everything. Now, you've observed, browsers, for some of these things, like recording audio and video, they prompt you for that. But the browser is doing that. So, because the browser is doing the prompting, it turns out that the browser, didn't actually have to prompt to do that. Could have just done it if it was coded differently. And that's a concern if we're thinking about what if the browser is exploited by an attacker? What if there's one of those sort of memory exploits that runs arbitrary code? What can it do? Well, because the browser is allowed to do all these things, it seems like it can do all of them. Now, for the word processor, we had some consensus that there's some things that I would expect the word processor not to be able to do, like making no network connections and no recording audio or video. So I think those are reasonable, and it's just not something that is easy for us to actually enforce on a typical desktop system. Like a typical desktop system, there's nothing actually stopping that from happening. If your word processor had a exploit where you could open up a malicious document, it would, if it took over control of the word processor, it would be able to do all those things. So if we want to not let programs do all these things, we're going to talk about how we can think about that. But first, let's thoughts on, what we're thinking about, how this works. So one thing that's kind of disappointing here is that we want to do something about, the browser seems to need to do everything, but it's kind of maybe our most important thing to secure. Can we make it so if it gets exploited, it's less bad? And we're going to look at some strategies for kind of having this idea that we don't need to let the code do everything, but making that work despite the fact that, it looks like our browser sometimes needs to do everything. And just generally, how can we, limit access of programs? And to think about this, we can think about OS support. And we're going to talk mainly today about ways operating systems can help us out with enforcing this idea that programs shouldn't be able to do everything. And the big mechanism operating systems have for doing this is not meant to solve this problem. It's meant to solve a very related problem of multi-user systems. So for example, if I log into the department machine, I shouldn't be able to accidentally or on purpose replace the LS executable. That should not be allowed. I should get this permission denied. And because this exists, the OS has some sort of enforcement mechanism, and sort of the pseudocode you might imagine for that is typically that programs that are running have a user ID, and there's some check, what files are you allowed to access? And this is in the OS's code. And it would be nice if we could somehow configure these checks to actually match our idea of what programs should be allowed to do. And on a typical desktop, it doesn't really work out that way because, the program should be allowed to access all documents because maybe it needs to access that document the OS has no way of knowing. So let's try to think about applying this idea to our web browser. And one thing we can think about is that even though this system the OS has is designed for multiple users, one way we could like maybe take advantage of that is by running our web browser as a different user. Now, there's a problem with that. And the big problem is that, well, if the web browser needs to access my files or my camera, the other user shouldn't be able to do that. But let's work with, you know, how we can make that happen. And sort of the key insight we'll use about that is that we actually don't care about running the whole web browser as a different user, but there are parts which we know are much more dangerous than the other parts. So for example, there's a part of the web browser that implements JavaScript and implements parsing HTML. If there's going to be an exploit, this is where we're concerned. And why are we concerned? Because this is where the stuff an attacker would control would come. And so we're going to think about how we can just run this dangerous part. And this notion is known as privilege separation, that we're going to have one application, we're going to divide it into pieces and make it so different pieces have different amounts of privileges. So I'm going to get to how we would do this for a browser in a bit, because in a browser, you know, the basic idea makes sense that we want to run scripts and parse HTML in a separate, you know, privilege, but implementing it is pretty complicated because of all these things that are sort of going to require our full permissions that the web page needs to interact with. So let me go through a simple example of a case where we'd want to do this privilege separation idea. And that's for showing videos. So if I want to show a video, video formats are very complicated, and there have been a lot of bugs in video libraries, video decoding libraries. There are tens of thousands of lines of code. They often have like handwritten assembly for performance. And you know, we might be really concerned about whether they'll, you know, have some way of being exploited. So if we wanted to display a video and not worry about that, well, we can think about what does the video decoding library need to do. So here, we're not worrying about the whole application, we're just worrying about this little piece, the video decoding library. And if I ask the same question as my prior poll there, you know, well, there's not actually that much it needs to do. It needs to read the video file as input and output images. So we can make this super limited in as far as what we allow it to do. We don't need to allow the video decoding library to access the network. We don't need to allow it to do anything else. So we can actually implement this where we actually prevent bugs in our video decoding library from, like, say, letting someone upload all my files somewhere. And sort of a notional way we might do this with a multi-user OS is we'll create a special user just for running the video decoder. And the idea is that that's a separate user, and that user is not going to be able to access any of my files. And I'll start the video decoder user, and I'll communicate via some inter-process communication mechanism, you know, maybe something like running it in the terminal. So in a Unix-like system, you probably use something like pipes. So the way this sort of might look is that our video decoder would, you know, start by switching to this special user that isn't allowed to do anything, we hope. And then it's going to read the video data, run our code that probably has some sort of bug that allows an exploit, and write the output. And we're going to run that from another program and display the images elsewhere. And now if there's a bug in this program here, because of our dangerous video decoder library, it can't do anything bad, we hope. Okay. So questions about this isolation idea? We're splitting off our video decoder into a separate program. So anyone see any problems with this idea? anything that seems bad.
It seems like in the second part of this, we're just trusting whatever output we get from the video decoder, and we're just using it. So I guess we would probably need some sort of validation that what we expect. Yeah.
So your concern is that, you know, we're assuming that this code is secure. The display image code. Yeah, so that's an assumption we're making. And the reason why we could justify this assumption is hopefully that the image format is much simpler than the video format. But if that's not true, and this is going to be a concern when we're thinking about the, implementing this in something like a browser, that's where we're going to run into trouble. So there's some questions about if there's the set user to function, couldn't it switch back? And the OSs will generally have a way of switching to a particular user in a way where you can't switch back. And why would the OS have that? Well, the login program has to do that. So we're going to hopefully use that mechanism. So the OS should enforce here. The OS, will not let you switch back. So what we're relying on the OS to be implemented in a way where this switch set user to operation is kind of one way, that after we call this operation, this program has no way of getting back to the old user. And that is indeed something that we need to make sure actually happens, but most multi-user OSs have that mechanism because the login program works that way. Okay, other questions, concerns? Okay. Any other issues we see? Now, so this is reasonable. There's still a big issue with trying to do this that kind of makes this unsatisfying. And that's what just a random user is allowed to do. If you're logged into, the department machines, you can, for example, you can read any files which weren't marked as not something you're supposed to access. And often this is not controlled very tightly. And we'd really like to prevent the video decoder from reading those files because there's probably a lot of them that are just accidentally unprotected because we don't set up like our desktop for multiple users. So we aren't usually concerned about what files are not accessible by a random user. It can also, typically you can open network connections because like any user can run a browser, any user can open a network connection. And you can also do things like, use all the memory on the system and make everything just not usable. Another big issue is that if we want to implement this scheme for a lot of things, it's going to become awkward for a bunch of practical reasons. So one practical reason is that switching users requires special permissions, that you shouldn't let just anyone switch to another user. So you have to make arrangements to give a particular program temporarily extra permissions, which you can do, but it's complicated to set up. Another issue is that if we think about implementing this scheme sort of, in the world, well, we want to like isolate lots of things and we want them to run as different users because we don't want, say, a video decoder to be influence the web page we're isolating to in the same way. So they have to be different users. And we need them to really be separate users because one of the things you can do as a user on most systems is debug programs that you're running. So if you can debug it, you can read all the data, change how it's working. So to implement this scheme, we want a separate user for each thing we're isolating, which is quickly going to run out of control. And another practical issue that it's hard to solve is that we have extra copying. That ideally, we you know, be taking this image data and sending it directly to our display. Here we have an extra layer of indirection there, and that's going to slow things down. And for a video decoder, that's probably a real concern. So we would like to have sort of finer grained ways of controlling what users can do than this user idea. And one common way we'll think about it is we'll try to think about how does a program do operations. And the primary way an application talks to the OS are something we'll call system calls, which are basically function calls that go to the operating system to do something, accessing, this is how a program accesses files, how it talks to other programs, talks to the network, talks to any devices, keyboards, mice, etc. And since this is the only way a typical program interacts with the OS, as far as doing all these operations that we care about limiting, if we want to control what a program does, rather than changing what user it is, we can think of another way of doing it is controlling what system calls it's allowed to make. So there are a bunch of schemes for helping us do this privilege separation idea, where rather than writing the program as another user, we're going to filter the system calls we allow the program to make. And Linux has support for this, which was added because people felt, oh, this is a really handy idea. And the sort of primary way is this thing called setComp, which sets up a system call filter. And it has a one very simple way it can be run, which is particularly well suited to that idea of that video decoder. So if you call it with these arguments, this strict mode, then it will only allow the read, write, exit, and this special sig return, which is needed for complicated reasons, to be run. If the program tries to make any other system call, it's going to turn into an exit, basically. And read and write can only read and write files that are already open. Which I wrote down here. And so if we think of our video decoder example, this system call could substitute for this set user to, and that would deal with our issue of these other things that we were allowing, that they wouldn't be allowed because, well, you want to open a new file, not on that list. You want to open a network connection, not one of the system calls that are listed. And so this is kind of ideal for implementing that kind of scheme. So commonly, this idea that we're going to take dangerous code and run it in this very restricted environment is called sandboxing. And we call that result of that a sandbox. And the name comes from the idea that the attacker can play in the sandbox as much as they want, but it's just a sandbox. They can't do anything important. And this idea of system call filtering is kind of a very lightweight sandbox in the sense that, you know, there are other ways we could prevent a program from doing dangerous things. So one idea is we could run the whole program in a virtual machine with its own OS so it can't access anything outside. This is kind of a very lightweight way of doing that. And the advantage of it being lightweight is that we can do this a lot more often. That this operation, this filter system calls, you know, is much, much faster to do than starting a virtual machine and doesn't involve storing like extra copies of things and so on. The question is, there's no undoing this operation? Yes. So this setComp itself is a system call, and it's not on the list of the ones that are allowed after you make it. So yeah, you cannot undo this operation from the thread which called it. Other questions? Okay, so this idea of privilege separation is something that is probably most prominently featured in modern web browsers. So pretty much all current web browsers use this design internally to make it less likely that a bug in their web page rendering code that has to deal with all this stuff that came from JavaScript and HTML from some place that you probably don't really trust doesn't cause big problems. And sort of Chrome, way back, kind of originated this design. And basically what Chrome does is that it runs this rendering engine that actually has the logic of generating the sort of web page picture in this sandbox, and it communicates with what they call a browser kernel that deals with all the stuff like accessing files, accessing the network, and so on, and communicates via, you know, by sending messages back and forth through basically reading and writing. So they've adapted sort of the web page rendering task and all that web page interaction to fit within the same model we saw for the video decoder, except now we have to go in both directions. And the hope here is that when we pass this HTML here to the rendering engine and there's some bug that allows the attacker to do anything, well, all they can do is send weird web pages for it to us to display. They can't, like, read all our files. Now, something that someone brought up earlier is, well, a concern here is, of course, that the, you know, commands that the sandbox is sending to the browser kernel, the things to render, you know, that's going to be more complicated here. Because if we think of the sort of things we need to do, well, we need to show an image on a screen, but we also need to do things like, oh, you clicked here, this is the web page you should load next. So we need to handle, like, requests to load a particular network. We need to handle, oh, please download this file. The user just clicked on this link to download a file. Oh, we need to oh, the user wants to upload something because we clicked on an upload button. So please show an upload dialog box. So the interface is a lot more complicated. And this is where, you know, why we still had sort of exploits in Chrome that caused arbitrary code execution. So the exploits were more complicated, where what happened is an attacker, you know, got some code executing in this rendering engine and then needed to find a second exploit in this browser kernel to actually do something useful with that. And the second exploit they found was basically a bug in one of these commands here. But that's a much harder for the attacker to do. So this really does, you know, make it, you know, a lot harder to exploit the browser. So questions about this interface here. This question is, does Firefox use a sandbox? Yes. In recent builds, it does. It took longer than Chrome to start using one, but it does now. Now, something that you may notice is kind of an issue with this design is that, let's say I'm accessing my bank.com and sort of browsergame.com. You know, browser game, you know, posted at, you know, evil.com, my favorite place to get browser games. In this design, bank.com is rendered using this rendering engine. Browsergame.evil.com is rendered using this rendering engine. So a concern we have here is that, well, we've prevented my evil browser game from accessing my files on the file system and, you know, doing those sorts of malicious things, but the bank is in the same process, and maybe that's what I really care about, you know, especially in these days of everything being a web app, maybe that's what I really care about. So sort of the modern variation of this and something that sort of Chrome has relatively recently started doing is something known as site isolation, where they don't just have one process that does this work of rendering websites. They make a separate process for every single website. And so the idea there is that now, you know, now there's no, now if one website sort of breaks that rendering program, well, you know, evil.com breaks the rendering program, the bank.com stuff is not in the same process. It has, would have to go through that browser kernel, that core component to get at it. This is a relatively recent feature. And it adds a whole lot of complication to implement it, which is why it's relatively recent. And the reason why it's so complicated, one of the big reasons is that a web page often will like have a widget from another web page. So for example, our course website has like, you know, we have our course website and it has like the calendar widget from Google Calendar. So if you want a separate process for every website to actually do that, you better run the calendar in a different process than the rest of it, even though they're rendered on the same web page. And even though like clicking one can influence the other potentially. And also this could be nested deeper. It could be the case that the calendar like embeds something from somewhere else. And you'll have this whole nesting of processes. And this question is each process sandboxed? So yes. So in this design, this is going to look kind of like this, but rather than having, but we'll have, so we'll have our browser kernel, and we'll have a rendering engine, another rendering engine, another rendering engine. So we'll have each of these, several of these rendering engines, and each of them will be in a separate sandbox, is how this design works. And we'll have one for every single website. So like this will be the bank.com one, this will be the evil.com one, and so on. But this is complicated because, yeah, even displaying one window now might involve talking to multiple of these separate sandbox processes in this design, but that's sort of the price you're paying for this isolation. And another sort of complication is that if I click on a link on the course website, like it might take you to a completely different website and we need to actually make that work. And you can also like have JavaScript interact between two websites. So that needs to somehow go through that browser kernel component. There needs to be sort of new requests that can go between websites when, you know, they're supposed to communicate. But this is sort of where browsers are settling as sort of the design to hopefully make it so, you know, when that complicated website rendering and processing code has problems, that it doesn't, you know, actually turn into a big security problem. And the hope is that even though our that browser kernel component is getting more and more complicated, it's still way less complicated than this rendering process. And hopefully, therefore, much easier to secure. And as I mentioned here, so Firefox isn't doing this process per site thing yet, but they have it prototyped. You can, like, if you download the latest developer version of Firefox, you can turn it on. Some questions about this site isolation idea. So Chrome is probably the most prominent example of this design, but it's actually been, it's been used in other contexts, and it's kind of a very generic design. So the other big prominent example of people who did this very early on, and when it was actually very awkward to set up sandboxing like this, was OpenSSH. So OpenSSH is probably the most popular SSH server. It's like what our lab machines use. And they use privilege separation to separate the sort of network processing code from the rest of the code. So basically, when we have a client, SSH client, like on your laptop, over the network, talk to an SSH server, it talks to this sort of sandboxed, you know, network processing code, which communicates, so this is our sandbox code, which communicates to a monitor process. And the idea of this is that processing commands from the network has all sorts of special cases, and, you know, they don't want bugs in that code to cause other problems. So they basically have the monitor process provide commands to access sensitive data. So, for example, OpenSSH needs to, like, sign things with a cryptographic key. So the monitor process will do that on behalf of this sandbox process on request. But if we have a bug in this network processing code, you'll be able to sign things with a timestamp, but you won't be able to actually get the keys that were used for signing. So that sort of limits how bad, you know, a problem could be. Similarly, this monitor process can switch to another user and move the connection over to another user, but it's going to do the authentication. So this network processing process, it's going to say, hey, I'd like to log in as, you know, MST3K with this password, and the monitor process will check the password, you know. And the idea is that because it's implementing that login user with password operation rather than parse the network input with all the extra stuff, you know, that's hopefully less error prone. And this is something that the OpenSSH people added, and it was actually relatively simple to add. Well, it was 3,000 lines, but in the sequence of a production-grade SSH server, that's not too bad. And they didn't need to change much of the existing code. It was mostly adding communication code. But you can see why OpenSSH did this, because, well, you know, there's clearly something about OpenSSH which is really sensitive security-wise, right? Where, you know, because it lets you log in as any user, clearly it has a lot of privilege, and they wanted a way of making it so they didn't run most of the code with that privilege. And this was their solution to that. And this is an idea we can apply to a lot of other programs. So let's do this sort of open-ended exercise of, let's say I wanted to apply this same idea to a mail client. So first question, so where should I be concerned about security problems in a mail client? What is the part I'm going to want to run in a sandbox? I guess these might be sort of combined. So this is kind of thinking, like, what parts might be worth sandboxing? So any ideas in the chat? I'm not going to have a quiz. Have a poll for this because there's no text responses in polls. Okay, so we have email content sort of attachments processing. Okay. Loading images. Sort of as a special case of that. So running files that were emailed, I'm not sure. So I will count this as email content processing, but I'm not sure what you mean. So I think these are, I think, seem like great categories. I can think of one more that I would probably think of as something we might want to separate. So something we might consider separating, I should say. But these are probably our highest concern, is like email content, because we know that, you know, that comes from random people, could be bad. Something else I consider is communication with mail servers, because, well, we don't really trust, you know, that mail servers, you know, are necessarily, you know, not going to do something bad to us if they're compromised. We don't want to risk that. That's where untrusted input comes in. But probably, yeah, your highest concern is email content and attachment. So what would our design for our mail program look like with this sandboxing? So let's say we have, so how are we going to sandbox sort of, what's our sandbox interface? So what's the input to the sandbox? And what's the output from the sandbox? So if we're thinking about, I'm looking for answers. So if we want to have a sandbox for processing email content, what should our input should probably be the sort of email, text, HTML, etc. What should the output be? So we could have a rendered bitmap. So we could do the browser approach, have a rendered bitmap. Now, if we do that, we might need to, we could render the whole thing. Yeah, so that's, so a simple version is that rather than directly displaying the text, we call this thing, which gives us a bitmap that we can just display. We could probably have something that's more browser-like for this. So that would be one option. And we could imagine things that are sort of finer or less fine grained. So we could imagine, maybe we put the UI for interacting with an email in the sandbox, or maybe we don't. And that's kind of a choice we have to make. So that would be for this email content. We have input email text and HTML, have a rendered bitmap. If we had to have links in the email, for example, so maybe our input would also include those user mouse clicks and the links to open. That would be another thing we might add if we wanted to support that information. Or we could imagine maybe we, instead of taking in mouse clicks and outputting links, that our sandbox would just output statically, here's where the user could click or not. Okay, so comments, additions? But yeah, so what we see overall here is that this sort of privilege separation idea, if we're concerned about security, this is something that is not that hard to do and sort of is some of the best things we can do as far as making a program resistant to attacks. And what we're resisting is, the attacker just can do a whole lot less. They can still probably do something annoying and something that we would consider bad, but it's not going to be the case that our bugs in our mail program are going to all turn into suddenly you have ransomware installed. They're going to just be the mail program does something weird, displays something weird. That would be our hope. Okay. So we talked about sort of this idea of separating applications into multiple parts. This kind of was based on the idea that we'd split up the application and communicate via this sort of send commands back and forth and have this sort of custom set of commands. But something we'd really like to do is take an existing application, not have to rewrite parts of it, and just confine it to limit what it can do. So we'd like to, we talked about our word processor. We'd like our word processor to not be able to open network connections. And this is something that there's support for, but it turns out to be massively impractical to use. So, we could limit what system calls the application can make. And in fact, Linux, that setcomp call, if you call it with more complicated options, lets you do that. But it's just not actually practical to use to confine an application. So you might say, well, can we actually like run existing applications without letting them do all these dangerous things? We'll talk about, since I'm out of time, next time sort of what practical interfaces for that are. But it turns out that, you know, the most straightforward idea of let's just look at the system calls and filter them, there's support for it, but it's just not usable. Sort of as an introduction to why it's not usable, well, let's say we have this open system call. Is it okay to open foo.txt? Well, it depends what directory we're in. And that's really hard context to get. And actually, from the system call filter interface, it's worse than that. Is it okay to open the thing that's at the string pointed to by this address is what you're going to get. And, you know, how can you possibly reason about that? So we're going to have to rely on some other sort of OS interface. So we'll talk about what that might look like briefly next time and then move on to some other mitigations. But I think I'm out of time. I'll take questions before I sign off. Mm-hmm.